The West Coast beat scene of the late 1950s and early 1960s sparked flames in the imaginations of many young malcontents who found little inspiration in mainstream culture, inspired by ads on television that touted big-time consumerism. Indeed, television sets had sprouted up in virtually every living room, and TV programming and advertising dominated cultural consciousness in America. Thus, while most of America rollicked to Ed Sullivan, Arthur Godfrey, and Milton Berle, and smoked tons of Chesterfield's Old Golds and Lucky Strikes, a coterie of young pilgrims were lured westward into the neighborhood of the Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco in pursuit of an alternative lifestyle. This is Jack Leffler, and welcome back to Voices of Counterculture. Lloyd Kahn grew up in San Francisco and first earned his living working for an insurance company, and then he dropped out.
I mean, I think I have kind of a unique perspective because I was straight. I mean, I hadn't smoked pot or anything until I was 28. And then when I dropped out of that world, out of the business world, I wanted to follow my artistic inclinations. You know, I was shooting photographs. I was interested in all that stuff, and the beatniks. Like I used to, when I was in the insurance business, maybe in 64, 63, I used to wander up to Upper Grant Avenue on my lunch hour and walk around and look in at the Coexistence Bagel Shop. And I think I got a copy of Howl. And I was very much like an outsider looking in. And the beat people were, I mean, not Gary and not Ferlinghetti so much, but an awful lot of them seemed to me to be bitter, that hipper-than-thou attitude. And they were alcoholics, and they had, you know, keys to another world, really. I mean, a lot of it maybe was drugs. You know, I just never felt much closeness with those guys, although I admired what they were doing. I admired the art and the poetry and clothing and the music and all that stuff. But when the young kids came along, you know, that were 10 years younger than me, so when the baby boom came along, they discovered all this stuff, and they were, maybe it was because it was a time of plenty that you could live on very little in those years, and they just took it and wanted to spread the word, and that's when the Haight-Ashbury district started flowering. Psychedelic Shop opened up on Lower Haight first in, I don't know, maybe 64, and then they moved to the Upper Haight, and then it just kind of exploded, and I had just quit being an insurance broker, even though I was making a lot of money, because I was fascinated by all the stuff that was going on in this new world I was discovering. And we went to the early dances, to the Trips Festival. I remember the first rock and roll concert that Bill Graham did. The thing about those dances was that it was word of mouth. You know, it was the Avalon or the Fillmore. It was word of mouth. And, you know, looking back on it, it was a magical time.
The beat scene had largely evolved in San Francisco's North Beach, a neighborhood that was traditionally populated by Italians. The new neighborhood of choice was the Haight-Ashbury district, located immediately east of Golden Gate Park, a neighborhood that was to become an historic proving ground for a subculture that was to become known as the counterculture. In 1966, Ken Kesey, Stuart Brand, and Ramon Barion Sender produced the Trips Festival in Longshoremen's Hall. It was a major psychedelic event, spiced by punch laced with LSD. Many regard the Trips Festival as the event that bridged the beat scene and the hippie phenomenon. Here, photo documentarian Lisa Law tells of how she and her husband, Tom Law, arrived in the Haight-Ashbury.
That's just when the Haight-Ashbury was starting to happen, and all these hippies lived there. And my mother decided to break up with my stepfather, and he moved into one of the houses in Nicasio. And while he was there, he got to know a couple of the hippies that were living there, and he started smoking dope and taking acid. And he was very against it before then. But after he took it, he was a totally different man. So my mother called me and said, your stepfather's taking acid and smoking dope. Give him a call. So I gave him a call, and he said, come on up for dinner. I want to talk to you. So I flew up to San Francisco and had dinner with him in Mill Valley. And he said, it wasn't that I didn't love you. It was I didn't know what love was until I took acid. And why don't you and Tom move up here? It's fantastic what's going on right now in the Haight-Ashbury. And I'll put you up till you find a place. So I went back down to L.A. and got Tom, and we came up and started living with my stepfather in Nicasio. And we finally got a place in Forest Knolls, a little wooden cabin just up the street from Ron and Marcia Thalen. And they are the ones who started the psychedelic shop. So Ron and Jay Thalen had started the psychedelic shop in the Haight. And we would go to their house and visit them. And then we'd go into the Haight and hang out. And we started working for the Oracle newspaper. Alan Cohen started it. It was wild. Incredibly psychedelic art on the covers and great articles about astrology and about agriculture and ecology and LSD and life in the Haight. I was shooting as much as I could. And Tom was writing articles, and then they had the human being. It was called The Gathering of the Tribes for a Human Being, and it happened in January 14th, 1967. And I don't know, it could have been 10,000 people that were there. And Allen Ginsberg circumambulated the Polo Grounds, along with Gary Schneider and Michael McClure.
The Haight-Ashbury became a subcultural proving ground. A group of East Coast counterculturalists who called themselves the Diggers moved into the Haight-Ashbury and profoundly influenced the evolution of hippie consciousness. Here, actor, author, anarchist Peter Coyote speaks of the Digger vision.
The Digger vision kind of began with a mysterious guy named Billy Murcutt. His central insight was that culture trumped politics, and that the way people lived was more enduring and more valuable to them and more anarchic and more resilient than politics. And that it was hard to imagine people getting ready to throw themselves on the barricade to be lumpen proletariat. But if people developed a way of life that they loved, it was not a stretch to imagine them trying to protect it and defend it.
Freeman House was part of the Digger coterie and speaks here of the culture of practice fomented by the Diggers.
Well, I met Emmett in New York when I was in New York. They came through proselytizing. I had a ready disciple in Abby Hoffman, who was a good friend of mine at the time. Emmett introduced his ideas in a meeting in a loft of mine in New York on 23rd Street near the Chelsea Hotel. And we were all really taken with the idea, well, with Emmett's particular act was to give away his name. Anybody could call themselves Emmett Grogan, and people did. And it created the idea, which in most cases turned out to be an illusion, that you could act without ego. I remember spending a whole night actually under Concord Bridge, of all places, high on psychedelic drugs with Abby Hoffman, talking about that idea of becoming a life actor without attachment to what was being acted. And that conversation really turned Abby in the direction of what he became later, which was sort of the national clown and a media performer. And I think it killed him, basically, the notion that he could do that and not get it on him, not be touched by the media adulation. It's one thing that the Diggers evolved into what they called Free City. The idea was that this would become a citywide movement that all the people in the city would provide with each other. An issue of the Digger Papers was put out by Paul Krasner that actually has an outline of how Free City would work, written by Emmett Grogan in there. And it has a poem by Gary and a rant by Allen Ginsberg and an essay by Lou Welch, and all of them are in there anonymously.
While we were in the Haight, we would go to Diggers meetings, and that's where we met Emmett Grogan, who is the head of the Diggers. And they would talk about taking care of all those people in the Haight-Ashbury. And Emmett Groven was a real visionary guy at his best. He was absolutely charismatic. He could get anybody to do almost anything. An outlaw and an anarchist, Groven was the founder of the Diggers, a loosely formed anarchic organization that was into consciousness raising. It was a counterculture welfare system that fed and clothed the stoned kids with all the dreams. That's what Harvey Kornspan said in my book.
So I got to San Francisco in the fall of 67. And what I'm describing now was the next 18 to 24 months, which seems like a lifetime unto itself in retrospect, because there was so much happening. I mean, you'd wake up every morning wondering what the day was going to bring, and the day was always full. And it was full of invention and communality. And I probably have my fondest memories of being engaged in writing at that time, because there was an ethic among the Diggers that any writing that was done anonymously, which meant that it could be done collectively, which it was. Most of these papers had a half a dozen sets of hands on them, and there was no feeling of possession about them. That ethic became so ingrained that some 10 years later, when I first made money on a piece of writing, I had strong feelings about it. I had guilty feelings about it. I had feelings of shame about it, which I got over in time, but they were real. And I think something was lost by losing that ethic, which was shared by a substantial number of people at that time. And it wasn't only happening in the Diggers. I mean, once I got up here, people like Jim Dodge were publishing copyright-free stuff under their own name, but with no copyright. People in Port Townsend, Washington, were practicing a similar ethic. Jerry Gorslin was running a bookstore in Arcata, the Northtown Books, which still exists. It was a haven for that kind of energy. It was a very strange time. Nobody has ever explained that time to my satisfaction. There were ideas in the air that seemed to come out of the air and were that widespread. You could easily correspond with people in Europe, at least, and any part of North America, and it seemed like you're all talking the same language.
And when the Diggers used to feed people in Golden Gate Park, and we would feed sometimes 400 or 500 people a day, to get the food, they had to step through a big yellow square, 6 feet by 6 feet, made out of 2x4s. And that was the free frame of reference. And when they stepped on the other side, we gave them a little square, an inch by an inch, on a shoestring, and said, that's your personal free frame of reference. That's all I had to do to get the food. It was an invitation to look at the world. It's there, it's free, it's yours because it's there. What would life be like if you behaved that way?
So as the Diggers evolved into Free City, the media blitz that was bringing people to San Francisco calmed down. Things began to change in the city. People began to have babies. That was one thing that changed. It seemed like the underground scene was stabilizing into collections of communes that were spread all over the Bay Area. So instead of providing a meal once a day, that effort evolved into delivering food to some 40 communes in the East Bay. Truckloads, literally. The trick was to send the most beautiful women you could find in pickup trucks to the produce market early in the morning and pick up loads of food that, for one reason or another, were unmarketable. And they usually had some blemish, like a blemished fruit or lettuce or something, or hundreds of pounds of chicken wings. At one point, somebody had a connection with a marine biology laboratory in Richmond, which would study whale flesh when it got washed up on shore, and somehow the Diggers got given the meat of a whole whale, which lasted for months, and everybody ate whale. Things like that were always happening. But it occurred to me somewhere around that time that here we all were. We were supporting ourselves on the waste of the American Empire, which was probably at that time at the peak of its affluence. And there was enough waste to support, literally, thousands of people like us. But not a single one of us knew the first thing about primary production. How to grow food, how to hunt food, how to take wild food, how to build for ourselves. Women kind of led the way in the next stage of that movement, which was to do human things for yourself and each other. Women led the way by learning childbirth. Scores of home childbirths that doctors wouldn't go near at that time. There was a great tide of good fortune running through all those things, and nothing in my circles ever turned out badly in that realm. But that was kind of the beginning of the Back to the Land movement.
Not everyone was enamored of the diggers. Lloyd Kahn, who had watched the evolution of countercultural consciousness in the Bay Area from the beginning, was disillusioned.
But it was wonderful until maybe 66 or 67 when the diggers arrived. Okay, so the diggers come from the Lower East Side. And they're big city guys, and they kind of co-opted the whole movement, and they were good with the media. And I see Peter Coyote talk about it, you know, and I said, well, you weren't here back then. I don't know when he got there, but the diggers was just a downer for me. And the whole movement, by the time the Summer of Love came, then the hard drugs came, and it kind of looked like everything collapsed. It really didn't collapse, it just disseminated. You know, the people picked up from Haight-Ashbury and went out and did all kinds of things which have had a fantastic effect in the world. So I just sort of think that aspect of it, and then the diggers were more of this hipper than thou stuff. You know, what could be hipper than everything being free? You know, it should be free. And that kind of went too far. I've seen people that write about the Haight-Ashbury, often it's from a political kind of consciousness, because maybe the guys who have a political bent have magazines that will publish them or something. But I was just completely infatuated with many things, including like the Monterey Pop Festival, which was, to me, that was the real thing, where Woodstock didn't seem to be. But the Monterey Pop Festival, it was like, it looked like a new world. I thought everything was going to change. I mean, I really thought that this is it. We're going to be kind to the planet. We're going to do things in everyone's interest, and we're going to farm organically, and we're going to have better politicians. And we're, you know, it didn't quite come about that way, but that was the hope back then. It was a wonderful few years.
Lisa Law didn't share Lloyd Kahn's perspective. She appreciated the work of the diggers and took many documentary photographs of them and of events in the Haight-Ashbury and Golden Gate Park. Here, she tells of the human being.
Well, on the stage, after Allen Ginsberg and Gary Snyder and the rest of the group circumambulated the polo field, chanting, Gary Snyder and Michael McClure, Allen Ginsberg and Moretta Greer and Lenore Kendall sat on the stage and recited poetry and sang. And the Grateful Dead played. And when the Grateful Dead were playing, Alan jumped up and started dancing. And I photographed that.
The hippie culture of practice that burst forth in the Haight-Ashbury proved to be ultimately unsustainable. Again, Freeman House.
Things began to fall apart in San Francisco. Lots of heavy drugs started to come in. People stopped sharing everything. About the last year of that communal experience, people discovered welfare. And for the, maybe the first year after that discovery, all the welfare checks would get put into a common pot. I mean, they generally came through women, the welfare checks. And once there was a baby on the scene, women began to notice it was their name on that welfare check and began to worry about the welfare of their baby. And things began to pull apart. And the Back to the Land movement began to happen all over the country. And I've always interpreted that movement as people moving out to learn how to take care of themselves, learn how to grow food, how to build houses, how to set up their own human-scaled institutions that would serve their immediate purposes and no more than that. If human nature was as acquisitive as it seemed to be in the American character of my time, is endlessly acquisitive. How were systems of anarchism ever going to function? So it was right at that time that ideas about bioregionalism began to be discussed, ideas about human society evolving within the constraints and opportunities of particular places. The rules for human behavior not being invented by humans, but being in the places themselves. If you exhausted a place, you failed. You disappeared. It was not a terrifically large jump to look at the planet as a place like that, and also to look at the planet as a collection of very unique places, to each of which the proper response would be their own cultures and communities. So that was what drew me to bioregionalism, was as an expression of anarchism, really, not as an expression of environmentalism, which, as both sets of ideas grew, there became more and more differences between them, environmentalism and bioregionalism.
One of America's great alternative thinkers is poet and environmental philosopher Gary Snyder. Although he's often associated with the Beat literary movement, he's actually pursued his own trail through the avant-garde subculture. He has been deeply influenced by Asian thought, including Taoism and Zen Buddhism. He has also taken a great cue from the flow of nature. Early on, he recognized that natural habitat was in jeopardy as a result of overabundant human presence. In 1969, he wrote a treatise entitled The Four Changes that was published in 1970 and was to greatly influence the flow of counterculture in America and beyond. Here, Gary Snyder reads the beginning of The Four Changes.
Four Changes. Roman numeral 1, population. Part 1, the condition. Position. Human beings are but a part of the fabric of life, dependent on the whole fabric for their very existence. As the most highly developed tool hyphe-using animal, we must recognize that the unknown evolutionary destinies of other life forms are to be respected, and we must act as gentle stewards of the Earth's community of being. Situation. There are now too many human beings, and the problem is growing rapidly worse. It is potentially disastrous, not only for the human race, but for most other life forms. Goal. The goal would be half of the present world population, or less. Action. Social-political. First, a massive effort to convince the government and leaders of the world that the problem is severe, and that all talk about raising food production, well-intentioned as it is, simply puts off the only real solution, reduced population. Demand immediate participation by all countries in programs to legalize abortion, encourage vasectomy, sterilization provided by free clinics, and try to correct traditional cultural attitudes that tend to force women into childbearing. Remove income tax deductions for more than two children above a specified income level, and scale it so that lower income families are forced to be careful too, or pay families to limit their number. Take a vigorous stand against the policy of the right wing in the Catholic hierarchy and any other institutions that exercise an irresponsible social force in regard to this question. Oppose and correct simple-minded boosterism that equates population growth with continuing prosperity. Work ceaselessly to have all political questions be seen in the light of this prime problem. In many cases, the governments are the wrong agents to address. Their most likely use of a problem or crisis is another excuse for extending their own powers. Abortion should be legal and voluntary. Great care should be taken that no one is ever tricked or forced into sterilizations. The whole population issue is fraught with contradictions. But the fact stands that by standards of planetary biological welfare, there are already too many human beings. The long-range answer is a steady lower birth rate. Area by area of the globe, the measure of optimum population should be based on what is best for the total ecological health of the region, including its wildlife population. The community. Explore other social structures and marriage forms, such as group marriage and polyandrous marriage, which provide family life but many less children. Share the pleasures of raising children widely so that all need not directly reproduce in order to enter into this basic human experience. We must hope that no woman would give birth to more than one or two children during this period of crisis. Adopt children. Let reverence for life and reverence for the feminine mean also a reverence for other species and for future human lives, most of which are threatened. In our own heads. Quote, I am a child of all life, and all living beings are my brothers and sisters, my children and grandchildren. And there is a child within me waiting to be born, the baby of a new and wiser self. Love, lovemaking, seen as the vehicle of mutual realization for a couple, where the creation of new selves and a new world of being is as important as reproducing our kind.
Today we've heard the voices of Lloyd Kahn, Lisa Law, Peter Coyote, Freeman House, and Gary Snyder. Voices of Counterculture is funded by grants from the Museum of New Mexico Foundation and the Christensen Fund of San Francisco. Our radio series coincides with Voices of Counterculture in the Southwest, a major exhibition on display at the New Mexico History Museum at the Palace of the Governors in Santa Fe, extending from May 14, 2017 through February the 11th, 2018. The exhibition is accompanied by a book of the same title, published by the Museum of New Mexico Press. Our theme was performed by Carl Bernstein. For Voices of Counterculture, this is Jack Leffler. Thank you for listening.